teams anymore. And it's been that long that that regulatory burden of customary and traditional has been endured. And I just wanted to make that point for the record.
They're saying that law. When I was 9 years old, I was in Chilkoot. 1910, they were buying fish from Chilkoot Lake. And Chilkoot side, all over, came up there and fishing. They bind to the canneries. So I think it knows about fishing. They stopped it. Just before that, when the white man came to Alaska, like Chilkoot side, there was a traps they put it in, piling. And the Chilkoot side, they had some traps all around. This is where it's coming. So our chief from Chilkoot and our side, Chilkoot chief, they got together and they see what they're doing. They're going to kill all this fish. There will be no more fish in Chilkoot and Chilkoot. They see ahead of time before you white people come around. We don't use no trap ourselves, our trinket. So they decided to have a second meeting to bring all the young people, young boys, when they get together. The two of the chiefs said, you go on this side, chop down all the traps and low tide. So is Chilkoot side, all the way. If they come to you, why are you doing it? You mention our name. So they all went and cut all the traps down. They see all that scow loaded from the traps. 2-3 scow loaded. This is the reason why they do it. And they caught them. They took them to the court. Why you do it? You know that's that piling, we put it up, it's expensive. And why don't you ask us before you put it up there? This is our land, like what brother was saying there. This is our land, you put the traps there. Chilkoot side, there will be no more fish in Chilkoot the same way. Well, they win the case. Then it opened for Persenis, came up. In Chilkoot, right now, there's lots of coals coming. There were a lot of jumps. So all the person are waiting till it opened. And our people watching it, what's going to happen? Soon as it opened, they went out, make a set. All the boats, they clean them out. No more fish there again. So they came together. This time, the line is going to be way down. Not the person is all come in. They know it, what's going to happen. So they had it, move it down again to Point Howard. Now, to talk about hunting. My father, my stepfather named Jimmy Marks, he goes to the doctor. They told him, the doctor told him, don't buy any meat from the store. It's no good for you. Because what they're giving it to the cows, that won't agree with you. Anything like pig or either some chickens, you can't eat it. So we went out hunting, and my brother Horace Marks, he's crippled. He can't go with us. So my father, he wants to have some duck. So brother Horace shot two ducks. He was going to work on it to cook it for my stepfather. And here comes the game warden. And that duck he's got, they took it away from them. They tried to explain why they kill him. They don't listen to him. They took it to Juno. So they told him to come to the court. So they went. Still they tried to explain. No, you gotta pay fine. We are natives. What we need, we could kill it, because that's our land. So all these things bother me. Myself, I'm going to the doctors. I got the pacemaker on me, and I got Addison disease. Same thing that happened to me. I can't eat from the store, but I can't kill no ducks what I want to eat. Our natives should have what they need to eat, because the doctor told them not to eat from the store. It happened to me. If I get something from the store, I get sick. Now, the other thing, what I skip in Chilkat side, in a tide, not a tide, the flood comes up, we know when it's raining. By this time, all the fish going up. After start the river going down, just like here, what do we have here? All the dark salmon got dried up there. They can't go out no way. My brother Horace again, he was crippled. He told Chancellor, let's get some of that fish. So they did. They caught some fish from there. And they see it again. And they took that fish away. And they told him, that fish can't go out. They're gonna die there anyway. And they pay $250 fine to get that fish. This is the natives I'm talking about. It's kind of hard for us to get anything what we need. But it's easy for the white people. Sport fishermen, they're protected. That's the way you get in the fish. But us, we could do the sport fishermen, but there are too many when they start catching the fish. We don't want to fight for the fish. What we need, we take it. But we don't want to fight for it. But this time, when I came up, I had everything coming to my mind when they talking. Our fish, we need it. I told them, you could put me in jail if I get some fish from up there. This is my land. This is the blanket I'm going to show you tomorrow. The reason why I'm strong for this year. So I'm thankful, brother was talking there. This is our land. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Yes, Steve Benke.
A number of people, Mr. Hammond and Mr. Pungawi and Mr. Morrison, have mentioned instances where state regulations have not accommodated, in their view, customary traditional uses. And I wanted to point out two things. One is that Larry Spengler mentioned that it's been a very short time since the state subsistence law was established. You're reviewing ANCSA, you know, which has been about 13 years since that major piece of social legislation was established, and the subsistence law was the state's attempt to deal with these things was passed in about 5 years ago, and it's really been only about the last 2 years since there's been any effective attempt to implement some of the provisions of the subsistence law. I think probably those who were involved in that would agree that, that there have been more strides in the last 2 years, at least, than there were in earlier years. For those who aren't familiar with the regulatory process, some of the visitors here, it's probably important to point out that the kinds of concerns that Mr. Hammond mentioned and concerns that Mr. Pungawi mentioned about the Nome River are able to, the state system tries to accommodate, to deal with those kinds of concerns through its very open proposal process where proposals for changes in regulations could be submitted, and through its advisory committee system. I know Mr. Hammond has participated in that system and in the board meetings, and I expect there have been some changes made that have accommodated some of those concerns. In the community of Klukwan, for example, there have been regulations adopted in the last year or two that have dealt with some of those issues, not all of them, obviously. Also, in the case of Heidelberg, Mr. Morrison mentioned a 10-pound limit on Rowan kelp. Well, last month, the Board of Fisheries addressed that. That concern was brought up by advisory committees and by communities and groups in those areas, people who harvested Rowan kelp for subsistence purposes. And the Board of Fisheries heard their testimony. It also heard testimony from my division. And they did adopt a considerably higher limit, up to 500 pounds, for individuals, households that take Rowan kelp. So I guess it's just worth pointing out that if you're viewing at least the approach that the legislature and state have adopted is a process for accommodating customer traditional uses. And given that, it's going to, you know, it's been an awfully short time since it's been in existence, and I guess it's, if you know, as you think about it and as you evaluate that, think about it, you know, in terms of those constraints on the legal constraints, the political constraints, and keep in mind that it is an evolutionary process.
Tom Loner.
Steve, I'm arguing with you that you've made a lot of progress, more progress than the years that I was sitting in that same office, but. I wonder if you think that definitionally removing the east side, or that is the Kenai Peninsula, as a subsistence area for the Kenaitse and so on, is what you would call progress in terms of the state's understanding of what subsistence really is about. When you have small communities of Alaska Natives whose communities grow beyond their own capacity because of in-migration, because of economic development, that essentially after a while those two communities become submerged and subsistence disappears. I guess I don't perceive that as progress in the management of some of these most critical issues. I'll give you all the credit for going through the documentation and assisting in the claims of people from Klukwan or from Haines, from Heidelberg, but in these really critical issues, I'm not sure that any basic change has taken place in the state's position. It still has managed to define subsistence out of the Kenai Peninsula, and it can do that elsewhere as soon as population pressures and other economic events occur. And it seems to me it's a very debilitating force in the long run.
Steve.
I think I'm not going to debate with Mr. Loner about that at all. I think that's the type of, I'm obviously looking at the narrower picture of within the existing system of what we can accomplish. Obviously, you know, that's the type of issue that you're mentioning is the type of thing that this body should be talking about.
David Case.
Sorry. I don't know, Larry seemed to be having something to say too at this point. I wanted to address not on this particular point, so maybe Larry would, if you were addressing this point, it would be more appropriate for you to speak.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up what Tom was saying about the Kenai Peninsula. It's probably a very good example of how hard it is to find, since the state cannot use race as a criteria, because of the state constitution, how hard it is to find some mechanism for identifying what you are talking about in terms of subsistence, the cultural, spiritual, as well as economic and nutritional aspects of it, how hard it is to find some criteria that is legally supportable. I'm not offering that particularly as an excuse for anything. It's just, it's hard. And the criteria they've got, the board adopted, is one way of doing it. We can't use race. And, you know, if you can come up with any better way, it would certainly be welcome.
David?
Well, I want to get back to a point that maybe is more general about this regulatory regime. And that is, I understood that you said that the allocation for subsistence resources would be made in a particular region, a particular area, and that then the rest, the other uses for that resource, would also be allocated to other users, personal use, commercial, whatever. That's the way it is supposed to work, or does work?
That's the way it works when the situation is such that the board is focusing on an area and addressing it in a under the methodology of the procedures that they've set out. First, the uses are identified. First, subsistence uses would be identified, then provided for, and then any other uses would be accommodated. Now, that only occurs when they're focusing on an area.
And so does that focus only occur when there arises an issue, when it becomes a hot spot, in other words? There's obvious competition and dissatisfaction with the use of the resources. Is that correct?
So far, that's the way it's worked because of limited personnel and data. You can only do so much, basically.
Okay. Now, my question, I guess, is, and this may go to, I know it goes to a point in one of the papers. I'm not sure if it's Tom's or Steve's or both. But what is the consequence to this idea of flexibility of allocating all of the resources someplace? In other words, what does it reduce the opportunity for flexibility within a subsistence, for subsistence taking of fish and game, if you allocate it all out? And could someone respond to that?
Tom Lawner.
Yes, thank you. What generally happens is that I'm sure the procedures of the department haven't changed. The department tries to identify what it considers to be a safe harvestable surplus of a particular resource in a particular location and time. If it meets the subsistence requirement, whatever standard has been historically present or documented or claimed, boards will attempt to allocate that amount and then allocate the remainder of that harvestable surplus elsewhere. So essentially what they've done is they've allocated a certain amount for retention as conservation, and the rest of it is allocated to a variety of uses. The problem is that once those uses have been allocated, that sets up another pattern that tends to lock subsistence in. That is, subsistence needs to grow and to change, perhaps. When you've allocated all of those resources and perhaps allocated them too close to the safe margin for conservation, you don't have any room left anymore. You have established personal use situations. You have established commercial limits. People begin to depend on those. All of those uses then become valid competing uses, all with real claims on the resource and with some claim to time depth. They are now dependent on it. Any change in subsistence other than making subsistence smaller is unlikely to occur. That flexibility inherently is gone over the long run when you have 3 or 4 or 5 years of that kind of legal development.
Steve?
If it's appropriate, but we do not have yet in place a situation in which, say for example, the village of Tionic, which has a specifically allocated proportion of the king salmon, that village is to grow naturally in terms of population expansion. Presumably, the regulatory process with a subsistence priority can be broached for the raising of those levels given the meeting of the subsistence standard of the new households. I would presume that that regulatory authority exists to do that. We simply haven't yet had a circumstance for that. I don't know. That's
Yes, Larry?
The regulatory system operates in Alaska. Anyone can put in a proposal for anything. So if, for example, the community of Tionic grew to a certain level, Tionic or the advisory committee or somebody could put in a proposal to raise the quota for the allocation. Whether or not it would succeed, I don't know, because it hasn't happened that I'm aware of.
Regulatory instead of natural, though. Mm-hmm.
Harold Spark.
One thing that's been missing is the natural limits on the resources. Again, referring back to the what our elders continually remind us about is that you have these fluctuations in population. We have, I guess politically, tried to retard new uses, new users and new uses of the subsistence resources in Western Alaska. The fear of our elders is that if you encourage new users and new uses, they have a demand, and they then get a legal status in the future. If the populations drop because the habitat is, let's say, lost by federal mismanagement or by state mismanagement, you can't support new growth or a regrowth of a damaged biological population. The subsistence people are not going to be able to change. They're not going to be able to move to the other resource in order to support themselves. Many of us looked at Anilka after we lost the battle in 77 and 78 as a native-only subsistence provision as a habitat conservation measure. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act was a way of us trying to protect the habitat, at least the upland habitat. We had a second major defeat. Many of the people in Western Alaska tried to expand Anilka 200 nautical miles offshore so that you were dealing with an entire ecosystem. You were dealing not only with the upland land base, but you were dealing with the marine system. Both are essential to protect the wildlife resources that the village populations depend upon. So in two areas, we were defeated in Congress. The only salvation we did get is certain stipulations under Title VIII, which said that whatever was left, the subsistence people had the priority on. But I think this issue is very important that you're addressing right now, and I think Mr. Hammond has explained it very, very well. If you allow a new user or a new use to come in and you don't protect yourself, either politically or legally, if the population drops, you're in trouble. You have closed the door on your own way of life. And I guess I would characterize many of our efforts as being a political effort to leave room in the future for the change, growth, or development of the subsistence way of life of our coastal villages.
Yes, thank you. It's almost 12 o'clock, and maybe we could adjourn in just a moment, but before we do, could I ask that anyone who has not yet signed the list of attendees, the list near the entranceway, might do so as they're leaving or when they come back after lunch. Now, after lunch, we'll hear from Tom Lawner, and it seems to be logical that we reach Tom next. Because all that you have been saying today is reflects what I have heard at the meetings in the villages over the last 8 months. People there feel very keenly what they regard as the loss, limitation on access to fish and game resources. And much that has been said by Caleb and Woodrow and Mr. Hammond and Marie and others is very much along the lines of what I've heard in the villages. And that, it seems to me, means that it may be appropriate for Tom this afternoon to begin the discussion by suggesting that the assumptions we've made are wrong and that perhaps an entirely new approach is called for. And we expect Don Mitchell will follow Tom, and then there'll be another open discussion. And I hope that our visitors from other jurisdictions will feel free to participate and to talk about their own experience and the regimes in their own jurisdictions. If you have any ideas about the way in which we're proceeding that you'd like to bring up, please feel free to speak to Rosita Worrell or David Case or me over the break or at any break and bring to our attention your dissatisfaction. if you feel that way, about the way in which we're proceeding. I didn't have a coffee break this morning because I think with a group as large as this, it's sometimes difficult to get everyone back in their chairs. But perhaps we will have one this afternoon, three-ish, and so you can all look forward to that. Let's adjourn now and then try to start again at 1 o'clock. Sure, why not invite him up? Anybody else that has arrived, yeah. Yeah, let's have some. That's my plan.
Tom, I'm going to do some rearranging of the table to try to get some of the folks in the back here.
Okay, good.
And the other thing I wanted to mention to you is Gary Hopes is preparing some remarks. He wanted to ask me when he should be here. I told him I thought
closing this afternoon.
But he said,
to our seats. George Irvin brought it over yesterday. I glanced through it. It looks kind of reiteration of the state position. And some AFN stuff that George brought over. He's well, shall we start in just a second? Steve. Just before we begin, I should tell you that Jim Sykes, with the earphones here, is taping the proceedings for the commission, but he also is running a PA system here so that we can all hear each other and that those folks who are in the audience can hear what we're saying. So I remind you that when you're speaking, would you draw one of the microphones toward you so that we can all hear you and your remarks can be recorded. Gary Williams is taping this these 4 days for independent public television and for the University of Alaska, and he will be developing programs to be shown on Learn Alaska and on other stations. Well, this afternoon, the proposal is that Tom Lawner should lead off. He wrote the paper called The Spider and the Fly, and If Don Mitchell is to be with us this afternoon, we'll ask him to say something as well this afternoon, and later on we'll take the liberty of asking Gary Holtas to offer his views on some of these. Yes, Tony. Well, I think that I think he's eager to do that, so perhaps we should give him the floor now.
I don't even recall the children's fable about the spider and the fly. All that I really recalled out of it when I was writing my paper is that I begin to view the federal and state regulatory systems and land management systems as a vast spider and subsistence as being the fly. And I have this vision of subsistence being wrapped up by all of these regulations into this tight little ball ready to be eaten by these somewhat gigantic spiders. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what that web looked like, which is the reason that I wrote this particular paper. And some of it you will find redundant to this morning, unfortunately or fortunately, because almost all the issues that are raised in my paper are raised by the individual contributions of people who spoke earlier, and I'm trying to put it into, just trying to take those same materials and put it into a kind of a storyline that seems to make sense to me about how to explain where we are and where subsistence is right now, and whether subsistence really has a future in Alaska. Everyone wants to start with the beginning, so I'm going to start with the beginning as well, because my story starts with the beginning. In the beginning, there was wealth. Wealth in the form of vast expanses of land and sufficient quantities and varieties of wildlife. The indigenous peoples who lived in Alaska had untrammeled access to this wealth and survived exclusively upon it. The natural physical environment of Alaska is populated by large aggregations of wildlife which occur for very short periods of time in any one locale. Now, while these aggregations appear immense by any measure, their density is very low compared to the size of the landmass and the length of the shoreline and rivers in Alaska. Nonetheless, the Indians, Aleuts, and Eskimos of Alaska have relied on these resources successfully for thousands of years and developed functional adaptations to this reliance. As a consequence, many of these resources may be considered to have been fully committed to, if not fully utilized by, the indigenous societies which inhabited these spaces. The state of Alaska, on the other hand, is a political entity created only 25 years ago. Previously, it was a territory of the United States. From the outset of Euro-American contact with the lands and waters of Alaska, Alaska was used as a frontier, a colony containing vast amounts of renewable and non-renewable resources. Its vast spaces were considered to be empty, its resources underutilized and impervious to damage. This colonial extractive perspective overlooked the rights and needs of Alaska Native peoples whose claims to lands and resources remain unaddressed by federal and state authorities. Upon the discovery of major oil reserves in Alaska, the United States accelerated the passage of a Native Claims Settlement Act. Land claims is a somewhat misleading notion, since neither party to the land claim settlement was interested in land per se. The purchasing party, the United States, was interested primarily in extracting resources from the land, not settling on the land. The compensated party, Alaska Natives, was relinquishing rights to the rewards of that extraction, but did not intend to relinquish rights to chase and harvest the wild resources which traversed or inhabited all the lands. While a provision in the settlement purported to extinguish Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights, it did not exclude continuing access to or priority use over those wild resources. Indeed, language in the Act and subsequent legislation establishes the state and federal responsibilities in ensuring continuing provision of subsistence opportunity. In effect, with the coming of American dominion over the land and without the consent or knowledge of Alaska Native people, their wealth had been usurped by the American government. Lands, waters, fish, wildlife, minerals, and forests all passed into government hands and were converted into common property resources, that is, wealth held by the government on behalf of all Americans. In return for this peaceful expropriation, Alaska Native peoples were surrounded by the protections and responsibilities of American citizenship, which, over time, they received. That seems to me to be the unwritten contract, an exchange of great wealth for simple citizenship. As a first-generation American myself, I find that difficult to comprehend. Over the last two centuries, millions of immigrants from Europe and elsewhere have come to America and were awarded citizenship. To my knowledge, none have been required to surrender at their point of entry into the country all of their wealth to the government for common use in order to obtain citizenship. Nonetheless, that was the price paid by unknowing Alaska Native peoples. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act returned a small portion of Alaska Native peoples' original wealth in the form of lands, but in a form considerably hedged by controls and constraints. It was at this point that the separation of land wealth and subsistence wealth began, as Native people were encouraged to select lands most suitable for development because their continuing subsistence activities on other lands were to be assured by federal and state governments. However, these assurances were in the form of social policy rather than basic or property-based rights. These assurances were seen to be as mutable and insecure as the ever-changing flow of power and purpose in the dominant political system. As Usher points out, government has expressed its exclusive ownership of and control over wild resources through changing land classifications, land uses, and the regulation of wildlife harvesting. The dominant social policy in Alaska from statehood until 1978 had been that no particular rights to sever common property resources accrue to any part of society by virtue of long-term custom, tradition, or practice, local residency, economic need, nutritional need, or any other factor. The government retains to itself the right to determine preferences among beneficial uses of wild resources. The state has many examples of providing limited access to valued common property resources, land, water, gravel, oil and gas, fisheries, and so on. Paper title granted by the state, rather than thousands of years of continuous use, becomes the validating tool of ownership, access, and severance. As a result, there is a serious question in the minds of subsistence persons about the relevancy of government to their direct access to the harvest and use of wild resources. In particular, the harvesters do not feel that the resources are or should be held in common, or that, given their negative view of Western wildlife management, the resources are being held at all. The government assurances to protect subsistence took the form of the regulatory regime so carefully outlined by Professor Langdon in his paper. It is my belief that the separation of land wealth and subsistence wealth may prove fatal to the long-term survival of subsistence as a mechanism for self-reliance for Alaska Native peoples. It is my further belief that all of the regulatory regimes, individually, in concert with one another, and in concert with a myriad of other forces in the real world, as distinguished from the formal administrative planning and legal worlds, will not only fail to enhance or protect subsistence, but will combine to slowly but surely strangle subsistence. In other words, those human enterprises which have as their sole function the task to maintain subsistence will, in fact, smother it with close and loving attention. Subsistence is a living, breathing, dynamic human activity. Regulatory regimes tend to place the steel web of exactness on the activity in the form of exact definitions, exact locations, exact numbers. This exactness cannot respond to the ever-changing human needs or ever-changing environmental conditions which comprise subsistence. Each bit of exactness, whether a land use boundary or a harvest regulation, combines with all others to create an indifferent set of constraints to this living system. The result of the interactions of these constraints is that public policies whose impulse is to be basically benign have consequences that are cruel, that policies which are intended to be passively protective have consequences that are actively destructive. There is not a single regulatory regime described by Professor Langdon which has, as its effect, an expansion, enhancement, or even restoration of wildlife resource levels, or which reflects the flexibility inherent in subsistence over decades of human reliance. The sole purpose and the sole product of these regimes is to allocate a harvestable surplus of some resource. As resources decline from time to time, or competition increases due to a variety of non-regulated and non-managed events in the real world, the harvestable surplus declines, and the most local harvesters bear the cost of the decline. Since no one has provided evidence that valued wild resources are growing, or that competition for these resources is declining, all that the future appears to hold is a continued decline in harvestable surplus and more regulations which limit subsistence in the name of protecting it. I am persuaded that the more local the regulation-making authority, the more the regulations are likely to reflect local realities and meet local objectives. This, after all, was the argument used to give states the power to regulate resident fish and wildlife. However, I'm not persuaded that formal native participation in governmental regulatory regimes is going to be effective in ensuring the survival of subsistence. While the unique arrangements dealing with the porcupine caribou herd, the bowhead whale, and the migratory waterfowl nesting in southwest Alaska are more enlightened than most of the processes of user participation, the ultimate consequence of these regimes is the limitation of subsistence. I see no sign that participation has expanded the subsistence enterprise. The more such participatory systems become engaged in the normal science preceding wildlife management, the more Alaska Natives become captive to the limitations and conclusions of that science. The control over subsistence that is implied by such participation is more illusory than real. As long as the forces of conservation, industrial development, land use classification, and scientific application remain outside of native control, the price paid for slightly more sensitive regulations is co-optation into the bureaucratization and proceduralism of government management of Alaska Native people's most basic concerns. Harvey Fite makes a most cogent argument about the ability of Native peoples to manage their own practices to avoid depletion of resources and still accomplish their work, social, and spiritual objectives. However, without control over forces beyond harvest regulations, such management practices will have limited long-term effects. Because subsistence is so integral to the continuous fabric of Alaska Native life, it is affected by all of the social, economic, and environmental changes occurring around it. Not all of the problems of subsistence flow from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, nor do many of the solutions. The issue of the conditions which are necessary and sufficient for the survival of subsistence is not only a land tenure issue, not only an Aboriginal rights issue, not only a state constitutional issue, not only an economic development issue, but all of these and more. If we look at the array of forces acting to limit the availability of wild resources and access to these resources, it does us little good to look at only those forces over which we have ready control, such as management regimes, management plans, government regulations, and regulatory bodies. Regimes, plans, regulations, and regulatory bodies are forces which we understand and from which we expect a great deal of effectiveness. In my own experience, they constitute a large part of the foreground in the discussions of subsistence, when in fact they should occupy only a part of the background. Placing them in the foreground provides an interesting arena for intense debate over economic and legal rights, while a concrete reality of persistent damage to subsistence goes on unnoticed and unchecked. Changes in individual regulations consume vast amounts of human and even professional energy, but alter very little of the subsistence enterprise as it actually occurs. There is a real fallacy in assuming any relationship at all between subsistence activities and the paperwork governing subsistence. I view subsistence regulations as small, angry mosquitoes stinging the tough, resilient hide of subsistence. Any one mosquito by itself has little meaning. However, vast armadas of mosquitoes, in combination with other larger forces debilitating subsistence, may have a powerful and possibly fatal effect. Each force acting on subsistence, nominally aimed at protecting it, has built into it little and, in some cases, large errors. There are regulatory errors, scientific errors, planning errors, observational and logical errors, statistical errors, economic errors, social errors, political errors, and industrial errors. Errors, errors everywhere. Each error in and of itself may cause only a fractional bit of damage to subsistence, able to be overcome, as Professor Langdon suggests, by the ability of the enterprise to adapt. But I don't believe it for a moment, much as I would like to believe it. What I see is a vast accumulation of fractional errors, which taken together combine to create the potential for disaster. The most important errors occur in law and regulation, scientific wildlife management, scientific human management, land use change, man-made environmental change, and political change, all in concert with natural environmental change. And I would like to address each of these in turn. Law and regulation. Prior to the enactment of the state subsistence law in 1978, there were a great number of regulations which severely limited, in law, if not in reality, the ability of rural people to continue to take and use resources as they had in the past. These limitations were justified on the grounds of biological necessity, management convenience, or increasing competition for the resource. Not surprisingly, these limitations reflected power relationships, not only among the competing users, but the political constituencies related to these users. Prior to 1978, regulations had been implemented which masked the usurpation by new user groups or industries of resources already committed to subsistence. The regulations were sustained by non-binding policies adopted by the regulatory boards, public testimony to these boards, and a lack of basic inquiry and information on the uses being restricted. With the passage of the state subsistence law, rural people did not have the right to